President Barack Obama is hosting Republican leaders for lunch at the White House today in an attempt to reach out to the party that has created the worst atmosphere of political hostility in recent memory. It's part of the president's plan to reach out to the GOP after it gave Democrats a thrashing in the last election. But according to journalist Eric Alterman, that type of outreach is not only ineffective, it reveals a perpetual political blindness by Obama to the fact that his opposition party has any interest whatsoever in actually governing. In his new book, Kabuki Democracy, The System versus Barack Obama, Alterman posits that the American political system is structured to work against progressive change. From senators' power of secret holds on legislation, to the overwhelming and legalized system of corporate political bribery, to the dominance of Rupert Murdoch's extremist media machine shifting the debate further and further to the right. Despite numerous strategic missteps by President Obama, he faces a right-wing juggernaut so powerful that it should come as no surprise that candidate Obama's promises have not panned out. Furthermore, according to Alterman, quote, President Roosevelt was pushed from the left by a genuine mass movement while advocating for the New Deal, whereas Barack Obama is facing the opposite. Eric Alterman is a distinguished professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College and CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. He's a columnist for The Nation, Moment, and The Daily Beast, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a fellow at The Nation Institute, and the author of 7 books, including the national bestseller, What Liberal Media? He joins me now from New York City. Welcome to Uprising.
Hi, that was a really great summary of my book. I can't do it. Maybe you could send that to me.
I certainly will. It'll be on our website, uprisingradio.org.
That was terrific.
Now, it's clear that Obama inherited a huge number of problems from Bush, large and small, and he's having to juggle them all at once, but he has also made some pretty bad strategic mistakes. Is his worst mistake underestimating the GOP's intransigence?
I mean, you're right. He has made some strategic errors, although I would argue that the system, the systemic problems are much more responsible for whatever disappointments we have at his presidency than his strategic errors. As far as underestimating the resistance and to some degree the craziness of the modern-day Republican Party, I don't know if that was a strategic error. I think that was a strategic plan to try and make good on his promise during the election to bring people together and to try and improve the atmosphere in Washington. And I think that he probably got a lot of credit from people for that, who voted for him for that reason. You know, you can say all that without doing it, which is what I had understood him to be doing. At least that's what I thought. It turns out that I was probably wrong about that. He really means it. He really does want to try and find a compromise on absolutely everything, no matter where the compromise is. And that seems to me to be completely misguided. On the one hand, and I think Obama's a smart guy. I think if I can figure this out, he can figure it out. And he must know what he's doing in that respect.
So let's talk about some of the structural issues in government that make progressive change very difficult. And I think a lot of people would be surprised about the secret holes that senators can put on any legislation as just one example of that kind of, that kind of roadblock, if you will. Is there any, can any senator put a hold on any piece of legislation? And if so, how can it be overcome?
Well, any senator can put a hold on any legislation, and that hold can be overcome, but it's a very long and involved process. It takes a long time. The holds were eventually overcome on the gays in the military bill, for instance.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Not on that bill. They were overcome on the food safety bill because some Republican senators didn't like the idea of safe food. The thing about the hold is that it can be done anonymously, and you can trade the hold with other senators, so you never really know who's got the hold on it. And unless the leader of the Senate, Harry Reid or whoever it happens to be, is willing to shut down all business and do nothing but focus on getting rid of that hold for about 3 days, then the hold wins. And so most holds are successful because they're on issues that aren't worth shutting down the entire business of the Senate for.
So a secret hold is, it sounds pretty amazing. Another aspect of what's built into our democracy and our democratic system is, of course, what I hope most of us know, which is that each state gets two representatives in the Senate, regardless of the population of that state. So, for example, Montana has exactly the same representation in the Senate as does California or Texas. How do Republican senators manipulate that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's built into the system, and that's never going to change. But right now, Wyoming, for instance, their votes are in the Senate are worth 12 times what Californians' votes are.
Per capita.
Because they both have two senators, and California has 12 times the population of Wyoming. And it just so happens that the most underpopulated states are frequently the most conservative states. So when the Republicans use their threat filibuster, they don't have to actually have a filibuster anymore. They only have to say they're going to filibuster. But when they use their threat to filibuster, in the past Congress, they've represented between 29% and 33%, depending on who joined in, of the country. So the popular will of 67% to 71% is consistently thwarted by this very small group. And because each senator, again, benefits personally from the ability to do this, particularly on the Republican side, because they stick together so well, Democrats don't do that very well, they don't have any incentive to change it. So there was a chance to change the Senate rule for the beginning of this session, and the Democrats didn't take it.
I want to turn to the issue of how government employees, how elected officials, lobbyists, and aides have a continuous revolving door to ensure that there is a sort of political stagnation in Washington, D.C. Part of the issue is, of course, as a lobbyist, you can get paid a lot more than as an elected official. And you point out in your book that there's literally a playbook that's published on Politico, for example, of how people can get involved, all the social gatherings that are happening in Washington, D.C., and that it is not a shameful thing to have this revolving door. In fact, it's quite expected. I think many Americans would be surprised by that.
Well, I don't know about calling it a literal playbook. The most influential publication in Washington is a daily email by a journalist named Mike Allen of Politico, and his name for it is Playbook. And that column always, it mixes up actual news with social news, and the social news often includes job switches from committee people to becoming lobbyists and parties that are thrown by lobbyists for politicians, and it's all part of sort of one big party that's going on. But what's really amazing, the example that I find most shocking, it is an extreme example, but it's an extreme example of a genuine phenomenon, is that while the House and Senate were writing the financial reform regulations, the chair of the staff of the House Banking Committee, who worked for Barney Frank, switched sides in the middle of the negotiations and went to work for Goldman Sachs. So clearly he had been offered a job by Goldman Sachs while he was writing the legislation on behalf of the House Banking Committee that was supposed to control Goldman Sachs. And that's an extreme example, but in fact, virtually everybody who works in those committees has either worked for one of the big banks or will work for one of the big banks. Many, many, many of them have done both. So the system is fundamentally corrupt because what you do, it's like clerking for a justice. You're getting paid by the corporations for the time you spend working for the public. So if you do anything that would upset these corporations, that isn't what they want, you're screwing up the rest of your life. And nobody sees any problem with that. They see it as actually no different as clerking for a Supreme Court justice. Mm-hmm. So this really gets to the heart of the corruption in our system. I mean, not everybody knows, but most people know that it's not such a great idea to allow lobbyists to pay for campaigns, to have a state where, for instance, all of the money comes from out of state and between two candidates so that the voters don't really have much say at all. That people get that and are aware of it. But this other form of corruption where in the writing of the legislation, it's just a matter of which interests are more powerful at that particular moment and reaching directly into the staff, that's really something. It's really depressing when you look at the details, particularly when you look at the details of this financial regulation bill, because this was the thing that the country was really mad about, that the president had a real mandate for, that the press was paying attention to, and yet we still couldn't get significant regulation on the banks.
And then, of course, there's the issue of financing and money in politics, of which our listeners know quite a bit about. It's an issue we cover a lot. But, Eric, I want to step back and ask you about the way, about how this political structure has become the way it is today. I mean, it isn't just a sort of happened to, it hasn't coincidentally evolved into this. I mean, we have government the way it is today because of very concerted efforts to make it this way. And it becomes a sort of vicious cycle when you have money that can buy anything and then can use that money to just perpetuate the system and can literally even control the debate around issues where elected officials are simply reading the talking points of lobbyists, typos and all.
Yeah, well, we've got a real problem in that the Supreme Court feels certain that corporations are people, and money is speech. And so as long as those two things are true, you can't really control the power of money, because corporations, and not only that, since the decisions, the United decision, corporations don't have to show, like if you give money to a candidate, if you or I give money to a candidate, it shows up on their, you know, on their disclosure forms. And we're held responsible for that. That's why Keith Olbermann almost got fired at MSNBC a few months ago. But if a corporation gives money to the Chamber of Commerce and the Chamber of Commerce runs a series of vicious, nasty, untrue ads about a politician, it doesn't show up anywhere. The corporation is never held responsible for it. So GM, you know, or GE, not GM, GE can claim to be a really good corporate citizen and care about the environment, and then they can fund anti-global warming legislation and so forth that has no basis in science. So unless we can, that's a really long-term battle that isn't going to be won anytime soon. It's been going on for decades. And in fact, the ACLU is on the wrong side of that issue. So there's a real lot of work to be done. The way that, as an interim step, we could try and work for public financing of our elections, which every other Western democracy has, and I think would make a lot of sense to most people if they could see how much money it costs us not to have it, how much money it costs us to let the lobbyists pay for it, because the lobbyists get paid back a gazillion times over. So the one argument I keep making is that people who work on any issue at all need to bring in the question of money, because you just can't win these issues when the money is so lopsided.
I'm speaking with Eric Alterman on his new book, Kabuki Democracy, The System versus Barack Obama. Now, you mentioned Keith Olbermann, and let's talk about media, which is a huge component of why it's hard to have progressive change in our democracy today. You say in your book, at least, you quote a Media Matters investigation, that at least 20 Fox News personalities have endorsed, raised money for, or campaigned for Republican candidates or causes, or against Democratic candidates or causes in more than 300 instances and in at least 49 states. Is it a symptom of how poor our democracy today is that Fox News is considered a legitimate news organization?
Well, it's a symptom of how weak the rest of our media are, that Fox is treated as if it's a legitimate source. It's not. I mean, it's not just a biased media organization, you know, like say, The Nation is. It's actually a big political player. In many respects, Fox is more powerful than the Republican Party. The Republican Party has to do what Fox wants rather than the other way around. Roger Ailes is probably the most influential political person in America. And they intervene. They play politics. They create their own events and they demand things of politicians who don't get behind them. Every single Republican presidential hopeful who doesn't have a job right now, with the exception of Mitt Romney, is on the payroll of Fox. So it's something very different that we don't have any precedent for in this country. It's kind of like what Berlusconi has going in Italy. That's the closest analogy I can think of.
And so you're saying that there are elected officials that are on the payroll of Fox. That means
they're not elected. That's my point. They're former officials.
Former officials.
Like Mike Huckabee and Sarah Palin. for instance. There's about five of them.
And so if other media wanted to have interviews with them, they would have to get Fox's permission.
Right, and they don't generally get it. In fact, there's a story, I think, in today's news that CNN's John King is complaining that he can't get the Republican candidates on his show because Fox won't give them permission to appear.
How does the Wall Street Journal legitimize Fox News? Of course, Wall Street Journal is also owned by Rupert Murdoch, but it has a veneer, at least perhaps based on its past reputation, of being a respectable, albeit conservative journal.
Right. Well, there used to be a much stronger division between the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which was always sort of Rush Limbaugh-like, although more sophisticated, but had the same kind of politics, and the journal's news pages, which were, in many ways, the best news pages you could find anywhere, superior to the New York Times and the Washington Post in many respects, and certainly on many issues. But since Rupert Murdoch bought it, he's transformed the news pages and made them almost as, not quite, but almost as biased as the editorial pages. So now it's like Fox News, and that every word in it serves the agenda of the right. And yet people still treat it as if it's the respectable paper it once was, in part because it's, you know, it's better done, and in part because of its legacy, in part because people don't pay that much attention. And furthermore, there just aren't that many news organizations that are being invested in anymore. Murdoch is willing to lose a lot of money on the Journal. He lost a lot of money on Fox, which now makes a lot of money. It was an investment. But the Journal is not ever going to make any money because newspapers don't make any money anymore. But he's willing to pour tens of millions of dollars into it. And just like he pours, I don't know, anywhere between $30 and $50 million a year into the New York Post, nobody knows the exact figures, to further his political agenda. And again, there's just nothing like that on the left. There's nothing remotely like it. And people tend to treat the New York Times as if it's a counterweight, a liberal counterweight to the Journal, but it's not. It's a straightforward newspaper that has a liberal editorial page and some conservatives on and some liberals on its op-ed page. But you can't compare it to the Wall Street Journal, which is like Fox News, just a continual assault, not just on liberals, but on reality.
One of the examples that you quote in your book is the way in which the right-wing media today treat Obama compared to Bush on the same topic. For example, the issue of the shoe bomber in 2001, President Bush got much more of a free pass than Obama's reaction to the underpants bomber more recently in 2009. And so these same media outlets are holding Obama's feet to the fire in a way that they just didn't do to Bush. Or holding their feet to the fire is probably a much kinder term than you would use.
You know, I think that's the basis of that is Fox's willingness to lie. I mean, to simply lie about what Bush did and what Obama did. And the rest of the media's inability to stand up to Fox. So that when Fox lies and creates an issue and gets their people all ginned up, the rest of the media respond, and nobody ever bothers to check and see if it's true or not. And to be fair, this is one of those issues where the White House is just bad. They had a terrible communication shop under Robert Gibbs for the past 2 years, and they didn't respond effectively, and they got beat over and over and over and over. And I'm hoping that I don't see why they can't improve that. But yeah, Obama responded much more quickly to the underpants bomber and much more effectively than Bush did. Bush didn't even mention it. But Bush wasn't asked about it. I had a press conference the next day, and yet Obama was attacked for not doing enough when, in fact, his reaction, if you look at it, was quite proactive.
Eric Alterman, what happened to the millions of Obama supporters whose email addresses went into a database that was supposed to have been used to help sustain the kind of grassroots momentum and base that built up under President Obama's candidacy? What happened to that plan?
Well, this is another area where I think it's fair to criticize the White House. They had 13 million emails after Election Day. They email addresses. They could have used those emails to help build a movement of progressives to match, say, the Tea Party that later emerged. They didn't want the hassle of a movement that they couldn't control, the same way the Republicans can't control the Tea Party. And, you know, the Tea Party is a very costly thing for the Republican Party. It cost them the Senate. They would have won the Senate if they didn't have to run these crazy candidates in places like Delaware and Nevada. So the White House wanted to run everything from the top down, so they just let those numbers lie fallow. I mean, if 10% of the 13 million people wanted to stay active, you'd have a movement of over a million people. But instead, they just get emails saying, send us money, basically. That's all. That's all that they're using that list for. So they let it die on purpose.
So then it certainly seems as though the one thing that can bring Obama back to the place where he was as a candidate potentially is a mass movement. And while there's certainly a lot of activity on the left, it certainly doesn't seem to have the strength of the Tea Party. Well, certainly they don't have Fox News as an amplification. Are there any points of light that you see around you that indicate that liberals and progressives and others are trying to build a movement to hold Obama accountable and help him keep his promises?
Actually, no. No, I don't see any in that specific area. I don't have any cause for optimism. The conservatives are they're much better funded because they're on the side of money, and so money is happy to give them money to protect their investment. That's always going to be the case. But liberals, under George Bush, they were able to put aside some of their differences for the negative purposes of beating this, horribly right-wing and incompetent and problematic for so many ways administration. But when it's positive effort that's required, it's much more difficult to get people to agree. And the leftist hasn't been able to come together. And so people aren't willing to defer to other people in terms of what comes next or what comes first and what to emphasize. Like I said, I think money has to be the center of the appeal. I think everybody needs to say, okay, we care about our issue, but we also, but before we can get our issue taken care of, we need to care of the power of money. Good luck to me on that.
Well, finally, Eric Alterman, any advice that you would give President Obama if you had his ear now? I know in your book you cite a time when you had a meeting with him as a senator, but if you had his ear now, what advice would you give him?
You know what I would give him? I actually can answer that question. Here's what I would say. I would tell him to watch the HBO special of John Kennedy's press conferences. And say, look, John Kennedy cut a lot of deals. John Kennedy was a very pragmatic politician. He did a lot of things I don't approve of. But the man spoke beautifully. He inspired the country. He moved people to do great things, things that we don't even know what they are, because he put out a vision for young people, for idealistic people, and just for everyday people. Obama could do that. He's a great speaker. We were comparing him to Lincoln during the campaign. And yet, on day one of the presidency, he decided to stop doing that. We saw what he could do in Tucson. He could be doing that all the time. There's no conflict between doing that and cutting the kinds of deals he wants to cut. So I think I would tell him to do that, and I think he should listen to me.
Well, Eric Alterman, I hope you're sending him a copy of your book. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Great. Bye-bye. Eric Alterman is a distinguished professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College and CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. He's a columnist for The Nation, Moment, and The Daily Beast, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a fellow at the Nation Institute, and the author of a number of books, including the national bestseller, What Liberal Media? He joined us from New York to talk about his new book, Kabuki Democracy, The System versus Barack Obama. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I want to quote from that book when Eric Alterman said, "The essential ingredient missing from Obama's campaign of hope and change was the hard work that would be necessary from all of us to convert the former into the latter, not only on his part, but on ours as well." That's Eric Alterman, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day.